This podcast is a proud member of the Lamb Podcasting Network. Find the network at largeassmovieblogs.com.
Top of the news this evening is speculation concerning the real facts behind the Department of Health announcement about a radioactive spill supposed to have occurred yesterday at the state nuclear plant.
I know what you're thinking. Mine's bigger than yours, right? It's not fair. Throw it away. All right? All right! They're coming! The rats are coming! Thousands of them!
Tell me about Disneyland.
They got tons of popcorn there.
Yeah.
And all you gotta do is go climb a tree to go eat it.
It was a night like any other night. Then something happened.
Oh, good Lord! It's unbelievable. It's horrible.
Hey, wait! There's something weird here.
Welcome to the Really Awful Movies Podcast, a celebration of low-budget cinema.
The sleep of reason gives birth to monsters.
Hi, my name's Chris, and along with Jeff, we're bringing you the very best and worst of horror, sci-fi, post-apocalyptic wasteland, kung fu, and women in prison movies from the 1960s to today. Check us out at reallyawfulmovies.com, part of the Crypt TV family.
This man is about to commit the most atrocious crimes in American history. Linda Githens, age 22. Valerie Hoffman, age 24. Marianne Stevens, age 21. These women have one thing in common. They are all victims of the Toolbox Murders.
What the hell are you doing?
Toolbox Murders. His identity was unknown, but he committed a series of crimes so fiendish that it shocked the entire country. Struck with no warning, he preyed on innocent young women. In his hands, simple tools became the instruments of death.
We're at downtown Toronto headquarters. Here's episode 87, 1978's incredibly sleazy The Toolbox Murders,
aka The Hardy Boys and the Tale of the Murders at El Patio del Sequoia.
Yeah, kind of like Seinfeld's Del Boca Vista apartment complex. So this one is about a series of murders committed with toolbox implements at L.A. apartment complex.
Well, yeah, when the movie begins, I mean, there's a car driving around, and we don't see the occupant of the vehicle. All we hear is some sort of magical talk radio, and all of a sudden the car comes to a screeching halt, and a lady, a dead lady, slumps out. And she's well and good, expired, and next thing we know, we're inside a very boozy lady's apartment, and she's waiting for someone to, I don't know, fix her pipes or something, I don't know what it is, unclog her pipes. Now, this is not a porn film, so I mean that in the literal sense.
Yeah, yeah, she's expecting some sort of building maintenance, and she's very, very much into the cup. She's drunk, she's stumbling around. It reminded me of Cassavetes movie. Like, she's a real boozy, like, old broad
or something.
Yeah.
She's like, well, what's going on? I call you Monday, show up Thursday. Well, you know, I guess.
Hey, we've been there. We both live in high-rise apartments. It can take, you know, weeks for your super to come by.
I guess the super didn't appreciate that at all, because he reaches in the toolbox, grabs a drill, and basically drills the shit out of her. Drills her in the arms, drills her in the back.
Yeah, done. And it's very, you know, as you said earlier, reminding you of The Shining, because she takes refuge in the bathroom, and then the drill comes through the door. Here's Johnny.
Yeah, well, it was a very bargain basement sort of reference to The Shining, as far as I'm concerned. But it was a bit of a Shining-esque element to it.
You might want to say it's a bit like The Shining.
Okay.
Real bit. Okay, yeah, never mind.
another joke from Chris over Parks footnotes. But anyhow, another interesting thing about this murder is that the music is playing is very incongruous as far as I'm concerned. I mean, this is meant to be a bit of a giallo, at least for the first half. I mean, we see
him with black gloves.
He dons a ski mask. So you'd expect some sort of goblin-esque pounding music. Instead, we get this really, as far as I'm concerned...
yeah, the country warbling.
Country warbling of one George Deaton singing songs with titles like Pretty Lady, Caroline in the Morning, and I've Got Everything It Takes to Be a Fool.
What's George Deaton known for?
Basically, Pretty Lady, Caroline in the Morning, and I've Got Everything It Takes to Be a Fool.
Okay,
so.
Nothing else. Okay. Yeah, it was sort of a weird, quiet, introspective, sort of driving music. It hadn't made no sense. Mm-hmm. But
you mentioned you liked the music.
It was weird. Yeah. I didn't like it that I would put it on and listen to it on a Sunday morning while making coffee, but it was just, I did not expect that kind of quiet, introspective. It reminded me a little bit of John Denver. Yeah, weirdly, you know?
Yeah, definitely.
Rocky Mountain Road, or not.
Mm-hmm. And, you know, I mean, so there's, you know, the killings have to continue. And the next person we meet is this lady who steps into her apartment. She runs the shower.
Yeah, but she's not going to take a shower.
This is bizarre.
This is the low-rent, surrogate for ironing your clothes, whereby you steam your shower with hot water.
But that was never made clear. We're just assuming that, because I just think that they just want to go for a really cheap jump scare.
Yeah.
Because she turns on the shower head, looks in the shower, and it appears as if there's some human figure in the shower.
Yeah, but it's like a pantsuit or whatever it is. So,
and then she goes in, she goes, she sees the clothing, she gets wet, and then she goes to her closet and takes off her top, puts on a new top, so as, you know, to give us our requisite
side boobage. Yeah.
And
I gotta say, that jump scare did not faze me either, because I could tell from the outline that it wasn't a person.
Mm-hmm.
First off, no person is built like that, in the way her clothes are obviously hanging in there. And also, if anyone were hiding in her shower, there's no way they would hide, like, run right under the spigot, right under the shower head. Yeah. It would just be ludicrous. You'd be, like, hunched over. I was not fooled by that at all.
My impression was that she wanted to take a shower, but then she got wet and decided, I'll take a shower. Changes her clothes, whatever. Then she meets the ski mask killer.
She doffs her top. So
exactly.
Lovely woman, you know?
Then she meets the ski mask killer. He knocks her out with a very feeble knock to the head.
Yeah.
I mean, this was just basically like swatting a fly. He then grabs a hammer and with a claw end bashes her brains in.
Yeah.
So this is now murder number two. Okay?
Yeah, from the Home Depot killer here.
Indeed.
Yeah.
She also has a lover. And the lover then is knocks on the door, you know, and this woman's name was, I believe, Deborah, and the lover's name is Maria. And the killer's hiding. Oh my God, Deborah, what's happened? Maria gets it. Murder number three, okay? And this continues on. Murder number four. This one is probably the most lurid and the most...
notorious, yeah.
Yeah. We have another lady who is into personal hygiene, but this time she's actually doing something about it. She's taking a bath, right?
Yes, yes.
And as she's not listening to country music, she's listening to soft jazz. And she's in the tub, and...
she's all lathered up with a bubble bath.
Yeah.
And she proceeds to...
well, it's interesting, because the music on the... and the soundtrack is something like "Take Me to Your Secret Garden," and as that lyric is, you know, sung, she's visiting her secret garden. She's pleasuring herself, and quite explicitly so, I must say.
Mm-hmm.
Killer walks in, turns up the music.
Yes, and you know, in the throes of onanism and self-stimulation, she fails to hear that the music's been turned up really loud in her living room. The killer breaks through and.
And there's a good chase, which allows us to see quite a bit of this this young lady.
But unfortunately, she is taken out with a nail gun.
Yes.
A la Nail Gun Massacre. And, I guess she gets one in the back.
Mm-hmm.
Can't remember where else, but there was a chase, and she's naked on her bed, pleading for her life.
Because she's naked on her bed, pleading for her life. She gets a nail gun to the front, but her wound is on the back.
Yes.
And she also gets one through the head. Uh-huh. Now, this actress, you're familiar with her
with
work.
Her body of work? I wouldn't go that far. But this is Kelly Nichols, who was known for being a star from the early 80s golden age of porn. And so I familiarized myself with some of her work after this movie. And
good to see you doing research, man.
Yeah, it's all about the research.
Yeah. So how's her other credits?
Hey, well, I did watch an interview regarding this movie, and she said, she admitted there wasn't much to her role, but she got nailed, mm-hmm. and she earned her SAG card as a result, so good for her.
So doing porn, she gets nailed, but she doesn't earn her SAG yeah. card. In this movie, yeah, she gets nailed, ironic. So she
yeah.
gets her SAG card.
There
okay.
you go. Yeah.
Okay. So now we have to, now you know, the police are starting to come around, and I mean, this movie has some of the most inept,
yes.
boneheaded, ham-fisted, stupidest police I've ever seen. And as we're questioning the residents of the building, who, I'm telling you, man, 3-4 murders in a building complex, I'm fucking gone. I'm moving.
Break
I'm breaking my lease. Whatever. I'm out of there, okay?
Yeah. Well,
just hang around milling about. They're being questioned about their sex lives.
Yeah, and after one murder, you figure, oh, maybe the residents would be on edge, as you always see in the TV news. Oh, I didn't think it could happen here. Second murder, you would think at that point you're looking for new accommodations.
Mm.
Third murder, there's got to be some extra security, or at least a detective to be stationed there to watch out. But no, nothing of that.
No, these cops.
The police are unbelievable.
Yeah.
Now, there's a young teenage girl who goes missing.
Right.
And her name is Lori.
Right, because after the killer of... after the woman got nailed, the killer, still wearing his ski mask, finds this young girl, Lori, who also lives in the building with her brother and single mother,
mm-hmm.
and he abducts her. He takes her away. Now you have murders and a kidnapping.
Yeah.
And you think that the police would be concerned about the fact that there was a kidnapping as well.
In the same exact building.
They
don't care,
fucking
yeah.
shit. In fact, as they're interrogating...
Her brother. Yeah.
Thinking
For no reason. He has no motive whatsoever.
Mm-hmm.
But they pull him into the police station and they interrogate him, and he's got no alibi, but he's also got no motive. So
mm-hmm.
they, for some reason, yeah, they turn to him.
And he goes, "Find my sister." He's like, "I wouldn't call this a kidnapping. She probably just saw the killer and ran away."
Yeah.
Like, okay, isn't that something to investigate? You
yeah.
saw the killer?
Yeah.
You're investigating a killer on a killing spree? Either way,
yeah.
find her.
Hmm.
He says, "You know what? If you're not going to find her, I will."
Yeah.
Now, one thing that also happens is we meet the owner of the building by the name of Vance Kingsley.
Yeah, the owner / super, and he's got a policy.
I think you just spoiled it by saying super, but anyway. We're going to spoil this anyway, so it doesn't matter.
Yeah. He's got a certain policy, and I guess it wouldn't work in my building, but in this one it's small enough that mm-hmm. his ethos is to personally, and he says this right at the beginning, and this is, he personally screens all the applicants for prospective tenants in this building.
Yeah.
So, which, you know, again, it's a duplex or a triplex or whatever mm-hmm. it is. This is possible. So,
yeah.
This is a guy with, spoiler alert, he's the super, he has the means of getting into everyone's apartment.
Mm-hmm,
not
mm-hmm.
questioned at all by the cops. A building super has tools, he fixes everything. He's a contractor, he does plumbing. He does electrical, does carpentry,
he has
a toolbox.
Yeah, yeah.
no questioning.
Yeah.
The suspicions never turned to him.
Now, we should mention this owner of the building, this super, Kingsley, is played by Cameron Mitchell. B-movie actor extraordinaire. I mean, you cannot swing a dead cat in an exploitation section of a video store, if there is one. There used to be back in the video store.
And we've reviewed a number of his titles.
Oh my god,
site.
I mean, this guy, he was in Bob's Blood and Black Lace, but I mean, beyond that, he was also in Raw Force, Tear on Tape, Without Warning, Deadly Prey, Amir Shirvan's Hollywood Cop, which he made prior to Samurai Cop, Cameron Mitchell. He's always a treat to see. Anyway, earlier on this podcast, I made reference to the Hardy Boys. The reason I did that is because Joey is investigating the whereabouts of his sister. He goes into one of the apartments where one of the murders took place, and he meets
the super's nephew.
Nephew, whose name is Kent. And Kent is basically, he's been asked to clean up the crime scene so that obviously they can re-rent the apartment and so on.
Because that's what you want. You want to, well, what if someone who should be a prime suspect and have someone related to him clean up the crime scene? But anyway, who am I to begrudge shitty police work?
So they basically decide to form an ad hoc little investigative group. And
Kent throws Joey a few bucks to help him mop up the floor.
In addition to cleaning the apartments, they're also going to investigate, not so much the murders, but the whereabouts of Lori, of the kidnapped girl.
And having seen the handiwork of the LAPD, I would say they're just as good, detectives as any,
Well, yeah, I think they're way more qualified, the one thing that's very interesting is that Ken seems to have an irrational fear of sex toys, because at one point they go into one of the apartments, and I believe this is the woman that was practicing onanism in her bathtub.
Yes, yeah.
And he goes, hey, look at this, and he throws Kent a dildo, and Kent just, recoils in horror. He's like, oh, it's disgusting. Anyway.
Well, you don't know where it's been.
Ultimately, creepy Uncle Vance
is revealed to be the antagonist. Although he was, truth be told, revealed much earlier because the ski mask was hardly very concealing at the very beginning. And when he did say, I personally screen all the applicants, I mean, I suspected from the get-go, the building super, I think 99.9% of viewers did as well.
Anybody with IQ over 40 would have suspected that right then and there.
And we're introduced to this guy through the kidnapping of Joey's sister, Lori, who we find tied to a bed,
bound and gagged,
and what's his name, Vance?
Vance, yeah.
Yeah, he comes in and he's
singing a deranged song about lollipops.
LOLLIPOP, and he's feeding and ministering to Lori, who's he's treating as his daughter.
Right. Well, basically, the woman we saw at the beginning, who slumped out of the car, Kathy, was his daughter. And apparently, this man. Okay, so now we know this is this fucking deranged, God-fearing man.
Yeah, he's trying to replace his daughter.
And he tried to keep her on the straight and narrow, and he couldn't. So now he's got Kathy tied to his bed, and he's using her as a surrogate Kathy. And he's feeding her Kathy's favorite food. He asks her, how did it feel when they took you away from me? But then at the same time, he sort of feels as if Kathy is back, And this is poor Lori. And, he's a nutter. He's quoting Bible verse, and he's basically saying, he basically describes, he says his motive. He says, well, what do you say, if I take out all the evil in this world?
Yeah, all that we'll be left with is good. So, we have this film that is half giallo lurid slasher, and then it just veers into psychological terror. And this I really didn't see coming. It was, it was a little bit... Reminded me a little bit of Maniac when he starts talking to the mannequins in there. So this is a weird, I think about a 15-minute protracted scene of him talking to this woman who he thinks is his daughter.
And Laurie,
that added a really weird, sinister element to
this. And Laurie is very smart, because as soon as he takes off the gag, she's just going along with it. I mean, instead of screaming or saying, you're fucking crazy, what am I, I'm not Kathy, he starts calling him daddy
and playing
along. And then,
which is weird that you should mention screaming, because I think every one of the victims in this apartment complex could have survived had they actually screamed. There's very few of them really do. I mean, when you see a guy in a ski mask standing at your door, that should be your first impulse right there, instead of just, letting yourself get tagged or whatever. But she plays right along with it,
and she's listening to this, to Cameron Mitchell singing, sometimes I feel like a motherless child. Meanwhile, we got Detective Jameson on the case, and this guy's fucking inept, okay? This is the guy that said she probably ran away when she saw the killer. I mean, the most intelligent thing he said is the murderer is a guy who knows what he's doing. Well, he successfully murdered people. Obviously, he knows what he's doing.
Yeah, for sure.
He goes to the bar where Lori's mother works, and he kind of max on her in this really weird, clumsy way.
Yeah, and he starts pressing her over questions regarding her sex life. And I think a quote today, I think it was him, where he says, girls today, they all seem to get around.
Mm.
It's just so insulting and degrading to the mother of the prospective victim who's missing.
And then says, I know about long nights and lonely nights.
It's very really creepy.
Just awful and wrong. Now, of course, with this idiot cop on the case, Joe and Kent, the Hardy Boys, are going to be, doing some investigating. And Joe snoops around, and what does he find?
A bloody drill bit.
And a toolbox.
Yeah.
Why the cops didn't find it?
Yeah.
God knows.
God knows why, yeah. It's
now,
the Black Christmas school of investigative policing. Mm-hmm. But really, he's there with the super's nephew.
Yeah, and this is where the movie goes into crazy overdrive.
Yeah, and at this point you think, okay, I spotted a blood-stained Drill bit. Mm-hmm. I'm going to get the fuck out of here and call the cops. Like, not linger about, you know? And, yeah, again, this
No, but he wants to tell his... I mean, what were the names of the Hardy Boys? You read the books.
Yeah, I did indeed. Frank and Joe.
Okay, so...
Frank was the older one. Yeah. Joe was the impulsive one.
So if Joey is Frank, then he wants to tell his Joe. So he tells Kent what he found, and now Kent just, like, turns on a dime, and he becomes a fucking nutter as well.
Yeah, and then starts... He grabs, I guess, one of the murder weapons and points it at poor Joey's head, and Joey is cowering in his boots.
And then he douses him with some chemicals.
Yeah.
And threatens to immolate him.
Yeah.
You know, throwing him with a lighter, and they start throwing matches at him.
Immolation is not the sincerest form of flattery. I don't know. Like, he tries to burn this guy to a crisp.
And he's singing Joey, burning bright, you know. And then he ultimately does it. He ultimately sets poor Joey on fire. Basically, Kent and Vance are two different pieces of the same pinata because while Vance is trying to use Lori as his surrogate daughter, who was taken away by the heathens and died, Kent has this mad crush on Lori, and that's his motive for being nuts and whatever.
And at one point, I guess even Kent goes and seemingly goes to free Lori from her bedridden confines, but he's really just. Yeah, as you said, he's got a crush on her, and it just really trying to put the moves on her.
Yep. So then we have basically Uncle Vance going after Ken, you know, calling him a fornicator and a heathen, and you got these two nutters just fucking talking about gobbledygook inanities, and they're basically going at each other.
Yeah.
They're stabbing each other, and anyway, luckily, Lori finds a pair of scissors. She manages to defend herself, get the hell out of there. The end. It's crazy. It's a nutty movie. It's a giallo. It's a sort of portrait of a diseased mind. It's a buddy pic.
Yeah, there's undercurrents of incest. It runs the gamut.
Yeah.
It's just everything in this thing.
Yep,
and there's also a strong female protagonist who is named Lori, a la Halloween, Lori Strode. Another interesting thing. This is and made around the same time.
Well, this was made a year before, actually, wasn't it?
Who knows? Maybe this influenced John Carpenter. I highly doubt it. But anyway, a lot going on in a way that you would not think, and in a way that other films of its ilk really don't pursue. I guess there is sort of an internal monologue and a lot of weirdness and internalizing of the motivations of, let's say, the killer and maniac, but a movie like Pieces really doesn't have the psychological element. This is a real oddball. Really, really kind of neat, too.
Yeah, no, it's sleazy. It's got some really cool kills. It's got gore. It's got a porn star in the altogether, pleasuring herself.
Yeah.
So it basically earns its grindhouse credentials.
Mm-hmm.
It's got Cameron Mitchell acting like a fucking nutcase, which is always appreciated. It's a rip-roaring good time as far as I'm concerned. I dig the Toolbox of Murders. And interestingly enough, this film was remade in 2006 by Toby Hooper. And I saw it. I saw the remake when it first was released. I don't remember shit about it. All I remember is that it starred Angela Bettis, who played May. She was in the movie May. And it was completely... The story was reworked, and there's some supernatural element. And then they even made some crazy, critically despised sequel to that called Toolbox Murders 2. But again, it has nothing to do with the original 1978 Toolbox Murders.
Yeah, and interestingly enough, there was a year after this, there was an actual Toolbox Murders involving a couple of guys who met in prison in California who had a van called the Murder Mech, into which they would entice young women and runaways with weed, and they would kill them using implements.
Mac. It almost sounds like a blaxploitation film.
Yeah. Fred Williamson or something. Yeah. The Murder Mech. Yeah. And this guy used toolbox implements, and he would sign his letters to adoring psychopath fans. The guy is on death row in San Quentin right now.
Is he still alive as we speak?
He's still alive.
Okay. Yep.
Fucking, he's been in the air for years.
Uh-huh.
He would sign his letters, Pliers Bittaker. His name was Lawrence Bittaker, one of the all-time worst serial killers ever. So that, the Toolbox Murders, the actual murders took place a year or two after the Toolbox Murders movie.
Well, yeah, and I mean,
and
at
one
the end
wonders
movie,
if he was
yeah.
inspired by it.
Well, at the end of the movie, you know, there's the requisite crawl. This is based on true events. Blah blah
yeah.
blah. No. It was not based on true events.
It was a la Chainsaw Massacre again, like a Toby Hooper. You know, get
well, but that was inspired by
Ed Gein. Yeah,
Ed
Gein had nothing to do with the chainsaw or
well,
family
exactly.
of people
no, exactly.
in Texas.
But what I'm saying is that
there's something kind of chilling about the based on the true story inner title. It's kind of, I like it, even if it's
complete bullshit.
Complete bullshit. Yeah. Yes, I was scared by that when I first saw Texas Chainsaw. I thought, oh shit, you know, and me and my 13-year-old buddies were like, oh, this is true. And then once you figure out that it isn't, it's sort of okay, fine. But I kind of like that. It adds to the mystique.
Okay.
And this thing, yeah, lurid. Kind of gross. It was one of the infamous video nasties. It was banned for a time in the UK,
mm-hmm.
but it isn't as violent as some of those others, although it is exploitative and extremely sleazy.
Yeah.
So what did we learn?
Okay, well, I mean, very simply for me, what I learned is that Cameron Mitchell is a treat. I mean, the man,
yeah.
like I said before... He's in more B-movies than I can count. I mean, at one point he had a somewhat respectable career. I believe he was in a bunch of Westerns and stuff.
Mm-hmm.
But, like a lot of aging Hollywood actors, they end up just kind of finding their way in horror and exploitation. And the man is a treat. I mean, he had a reputation as being a drunkard. at the end of his career, I mean, he would just... Oh, man. Like, you could just tell the guy was fucking, like, off... well in his cups when he was performing. But you know what? In this one, he was more or less committed, I think. I think he only maybe just had, like, you know, two beers instead of, like, a 2-4. But, I mean, you know, I love Cameron Mitchell. And it's good to see him as, you know, the real protagonist of the film. Because mostly he's not. He's, like, just sort of, like, this buffoon who's sort of, like, you know... Either the police captain or somebody like that, or just
he's got his square jaw, some authoritative kind of look. What I learned is that, you know, this gives us a little glimpse into 70s culture, and there's references to TV dinner. I think a joke about where the boyfriend wants his girlfriend to cook for him, and oh, what are we having tonight? Oh, a TV dinner. I'm going to reheat it, and there's some product placement. Involving Dr. Pepper and Pepsi.
Yes, I know.
Where one of the
victims
is, I guess, studying for an exam. She's a college student, and she's doing some sort of paper on Brazil, I believe, or some sort of weird paper. And in the midst of writing notes for this academic treatise, she's killed or knocked out. I forget which. And the Pepsi falls over, and we get this lingering shots of Pepsi with the brown. You know, sugary goo dripping onto the floor, you know, and also I learned that some of the victims did unnatural things. So a few of them had, I guess, you want to say shady past. There was one who was involved in porn. I can't remember whether it was the actual porn star, Kelly Nichols, but one of them had some dirty pictures that were laid out on the table.
Mm-hmm.
The dutiful detectives were carefully examining, I'm sure. Nudge, nudge, wink, wink. And the other one, I guess you mentioned the lesbian character.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, interesting.
Yeah, and the other one was a goose hound. And,
So that was
the motive. And
yeah, he was punishing people who were couldn't control their urges.
Mm-hmm.
Star rating.
Well, before you do that, I was going to ask you about the TV dinner thing. There was a time in my life when I actually enjoyed a good TV dinner.
Oh my God.
You never? No.
My parents did not subject me to those.
Well, this is when I was living on my own. But,
okay.
Yeah.
No, this past weekend I subjected myself to a frozen pizza dinner, and that was very depressing.
Yeah.
There are exactly zero good frozen pizzas on the market today.
It's so true. And that whole thing about, like, oh, is it delivery? Is it Delicioso? I'm going to call bullshit on that one, man.
Yeah, it's,
you know,
it's
anybody
awful.
That will mistake Delicioso for, like, a delivery pizza.
Yeah,
you know.
They've got to have their palate examined.
Exactly.
Yeah, it's just brutal.
No, I remember, as a kid, I wanted to eat TV dinners. They looked enticing.
Huh.
I was fascinated by the fact they were called TV dinners.
Yeah.
I thought that maybe there was...
Because you love TV.
Exactly, yeah. So, and then when all I could afford was TV dinners, I mean, I developed a bit of a taste for, like, you know, your Swanson Salisbury steaks and your turkey dinners
and
stuff.
One step removed, I think, are slightly better than airplane food. of which, you know, many an 80s comedian, you know, staked their career on. So
No, they were vile, but, you know, with that, you know, it's sometimes, you know, you got to do what you got to do. It's either ramen or a TV dinner, right?
So, true enough. So like, from one-star cuisine to our one- to five-star rating scale, what would you give The Toolbox Murders?
It's a solid three as far as I'm concerned. Mm-hmm. Yep. Maybe a 3.5 even?
Yeah, it had some really neat giallo-esque aspects, some kind of subdued, neat soundtrack music, really some spotty performances as par for the course for this type of thing, but I think it's better than Pieces. Incorporating the more psychological element a la Maniac puts it a cut above some of its brethren, because that's something that's seldom explored and I think often enhances a film, like what is the killer's motivation. So as spotty as these ones may be, it is kind of
just, you know, to be a little critical, I mean, the fact he's just like this God-fearing man who wants to cleanse the world of all heathens and sinners and so on, I mean, that's not the most original. That's pretty boring.
Better that than a prologue where a kid gets abused and then 20 years later he becomes a killer. That is the most hoary
example.
Or sees
his mom, you know, like having sex.
Yeah.
You know, that happens a lot. Oh, my mom was a prostitute. Yeah, you know, that sort of thing. So, yeah.
Yeah, I believe, maybe that was, I think, the prologue for The Boogeyman.
Many movies. Fuck, man. Too many to count.
Yeah.
Anyhow. Yeah, so I'm going to say 3.5. Mm-hmm. I enjoy it. I can recommend it.
For sure. And check out our 5-star website with reviews.
4.
Okay.
Maybe 4.5.
2 or 3 times a week. We're part of Eli Roth's Crypt TV family. Follow us on Twitter, awful_movies, and Facebook as well. And check us out, and we'll talk to you soon. Every weekend, new episodes.
Take care.